Welcome to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Georgine Rice Show. James Blend producing, Dave King engineering in Portland, Pedro Bartes producing and engineering in Seattle. Today I'm looking forward to a conversation with Kayla Toney. She's an associate counsel at First Liberty Institute. She focuses on religious liberty and First Amendment rights. She's going to talk about an Issaquah pair, a couple of elementary school girls who wanted to start a prayer club in their school and were denied. We'll explain when she joins us later this hour. But first, some of the day's headlines. Well, Senate Democrats killed both articles of impeachment against the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas. Impeachment has become something of a different animal than it was originally. But nonetheless, the first two articles of impeachment allege Mayorkas engaged in the willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law regarding the southern border in his capacity as DHS secretary. The second claimed Mayorkas had breached public trust. Now, high crimes and misdemeanors, does it rise to that level? Is it a policy disagreement? Majority Leader Chuck Schumer proposed a point of order declaring the first article unconstitutional, to which the majority of senators agreed following several failed motions by Republicans. The outcome was pretty much as predicted. The article was deemed unconstitutional by a vote of 51-48, with Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, voting present. Schumer's point of order was proposed after his request for unanimous consent, which would have provided a set amount of time for debate among senators, as well as votes on two GOP resolutions, and set an amount of agreement upon points of order, which was objected to by Senator Eric Schmidt from Missouri. Schmidt stated in his objection that the Senate should conduct a full trial into the impeachment articles against Mayorkas rather than the debate and points of order suggested by Schumer's unanimous consent request, which would be followed by a likely successful motion to dismiss the articles. Republican senators took issue with Schumer's point of order, as agreeing to it would effectively kill the first of the two articles. Several GOP lawmakers proposed motions which took precedence over the point of order to adjourn or table the point, among other things, but all GOP motions failed as expected. This process must not be abused. It must not be short-circuited. History will not judge this moment well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said as he motioned to table the point of order from Schumer. After another batch of motions to avoid voting on Schumer's second point of order, which would deem the second article unconstitutional, the Senate agreed to it. The vote was along party lines, 51-49, with Murkowski rejoining the Republicans. Meanwhile, a nonprofit legal organization filed a lawsuit against the Biden administration today, alleging it has deleted federal employees' emails in violation of existing statute. And a sweeping complaint filed by the U.S., or rather in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, the America First Legal Foundation, the group headed by former Trump advisor Stephen Miller, accused the Department of Health and Human Services of regularly deleting official emails and violating the Federal Records Act. The group also named the National Archives and Records Administration, which is tasked with overseeing the unlawful destruction of federal records, as defendant. If the National Archives decides not to use the legal authorities it has regarding federal records, it certainly shouldn't make up legal authority that it doesn't have when it comes to presidential records, American First Legal Vice President Dan Epstein said in an interview. We expect our government to act in a transparent and accountable way and exercise equanimity when it is deciding to investigate certain allegations. We clearly haven't seen that in this case. Well, according to the lawsuit, it will have deep ramifications in Special Counsel Jack Smith's ongoing case against former President Donald Trump. Smith is prosecuting Trump in connection to the former president's handling of classified documents and other presidential records after leaving the White House in early 21. In June of 23, the Department of Justice unsealed a federal indictment accusing Trump of 37 felony counts in connection with obstruction of justice and mishandling government records. Epstein, though, argues that Trump is being held to a different standard than federal employees who regularly delete emails and records without any repercussions. He said potentially tens of thousands of records are deleted every year without authority. The first question to be addressed is whether or not they have standing, and then the merits will likely be the focus of that case. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left no doubt in a statement on Wednesday regarding what his Jewish country might do should current tensions with Iran escalate further. Israel will do whatever it needs to defend itself, he said in a statement. Well, the comment came after separate meetings with British Foreign Secretary David Cameron and Germany's Foreign Minister Baerbock in Israel on Wednesday, where the ministers discussed actions Israel could pursue to retaliate for Iran's unprecedented direct attack on Israel over the weekend. They have all sorts of suggestions and advice. I appreciate that. But I want to be clear. Our decisions we will make ourselves, the prime minister added. Well, during the meeting, Baerbock said escalation would serve no one, not Israel's security, not the many dozens of hostages still in the hands of Hamas, not the suffering population of Gaza, not the many people in Iran who are themselves suffering under the regime, and not the third countries in the region who simply want to live in peace, Reuters reported. Netanyahu's comments also come just hours after Iran's president has vowed to completely destroy Israel should it proceed with even the tiniest invasion of its country. President Ibrahim Raisi vowed a massive and harsh response to potential Israeli retaliation during a speech on Wednesday at an annual army parade. Iran launched hundreds of missiles and drones at Israel on Saturday in response to an apparent strike on Iran's embassy compound in Syria on April 1st. It killed 12 people, including two Iranian generals. Iran blames Israel for the attack, although Israel has not claimed involvement. We'll continue to follow that story. Well, as mentioned, Western powers are urging the Israeli government to show restraint in its expected response to the missile strikes last week. Officials from Germany, the United Kingdom, and elsewhere have asked Israeli Prime Minister not to escalate. It's right to have made your views clear about what should happen next, but it's clear the Israelis are making the decision to act. The British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, a former prime minister, reported on Wednesday. He added, "We hope they do so in a way that does as little to escalate this as possible. The expectation is something will happen." Well, radical left activists are back at it with a tactic that feels like deja vu. These weren't your peaceful protesters rallying on Monday in solidarity with Palestinians. These are disruptors who view chaos as a stepping stone to their anti-capitalist utopia. They're just pretending to care about what happens in Gaza. It's crucial that city leaders step up now. If they don't, we're not just looking at a repeat of past disruptions. We're staring down a potentially more vicious wave of activism that threatens our economy. So writes Jason Rance, suggesting that anti-Israeli protesters shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge, disrupting America, is only the beginning. From the Golden Gate Bridge, he writes, in San Francisco to the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, activists snarled traffic, created a hellish commute for people just trying to get home or to work. Passengers likely missed flights out of SeaTac Airport in Seattle and Chicago O'Hare International Airport, thanks to activists blocking the roads in. The methods are right out of an anarchist's handbook, Sleeping Dragon Tactics, where protesters handcuff themselves together inside PVC pipes, make a logistical nightmare for police to intervene. Some even go so far as chaining themselves to barrels filled with concrete or using their vehicles to clog the roads. Why are we seeing this surge in direct action? Well, we've seen it work. The anti-police violence during the peak of the Black Lives Matter movement got them the headlines, the chaos they desired. And without significant consequences, why stop? Take Seattle's I-5 freeway takeover on January 6th, months later. Those identified haven't even faced charges. Monday's activists will get off with a slap in the wrist, like a fine or, at worst, some restorative justice program that barely registers as punishment. These activists aren't just random activists looking to be a part of something bigger than themselves. They're diehards who see themselves as martyrs in the war, not against oppression in Gaza, but against capitalism itself. And despite the banners of Free Palestine and slogans against genocide, the real battle is with the economic system they despise. Death to America, death to Israel. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgene Rice. One final thought on the Disrupt America movement. When law enforcement finally acted against Antifa, driven in part by a public that was getting tired of the violence came to an end. But the activists hadn't dismantled the biggest system of oppression as they had hoped. They'd been biding their time until there was another massive movement that they could exploit or infiltrate. Who knew it would be Hamas terrorists that would reignite their activism? So what's next? Unless city leaders take a firmer stance against these disruptions, expect things to escalate. We're not just dealing with a protest. It's an all-out assault on the structure of society by those who believe they have nothing to lose. If left unchecked, this movement could morph into something even more dangerous than what we witnessed with Antifa and BLM. The time for half measures is over. It's time to confront these tactics head on and restore order for everyone's sake. Again, referring to a column by Jason Rantz earlier today. Well, House Republicans grilled Columbia's university's president over employment of a professor who called October 7th the Hamas attack awesome. Well, the new testimony came several months after another hearing on campus, anti-Semitism, where lawmakers grilled the presidents of Harvard, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania. House Republicans on Wednesday grilled Columbia University President Dr. Nemet Shafik regarding the employment of a professor who celebrated the October 7th Hamas attacks as awesome. Well, during the House Education and Workforce hearing to discuss anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus, Representative Tim Wall condemned what he called a perverse statement by a tenured Columbia professor, Joseph Massad, who is listed as the chair of the School of Arts and Science Academy Review Committee. In the aftermath of October 7th, he penned an article praising the innovative Palestinian resistance and Hamas militants for attacking Israel and glorifying Hamas's slaughter of more than 1,200 Jews. He described the terror attack on southern Israel as awesome, astonishing, astounding, and incredible. Professor Massad has also been known to have called Israel's, quote, cruel and bloodthirsty colonizers, end quote, and who joined them, Israeli military, as, quote, baby-killing Zionists, Jewish volunteers, and it goes on from there. In 2005, an investigation by Columbia corroborated allegations that Massad yelled at a Jewish student who questioned his views to, quote, get out of my classroom. Can you imagine free speech diversity on campus? Well, Wahlberg blasted how, as chair of the School of Arts and Science Academy Review Committee, Massad oversees the periodic review of all departments, centers, and institutes in the school. The congressman asked the president if Massad had faced any consequences for his words. He has been spoken to. The president said, spoken to. When pressed about whether Massad had faced any further consequences, the president of Columbia said that he had been removed as chair of the committee. Later on, House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik stated that Massad is still listed as chair on the school's website. Shafik said she would have to confirm whether he was still serving in that role. When Stefanik pressed the president on whether she would remove him from that role if he was indeed still in that position, she ultimately, after a very long period of time, said yes. Wahlberg noted that Massad is a tenured professor and asked Columbia Board of Trustee co-chair Claire Shipman and David Greenwald if they would approve tenure for him if they could make the decision today. Both said they would not. Well, soon the government might shut down your car. What preposterous claim is that? Well, according to John Stossel, President Joe Biden's new infrastructure gives bureaucrats that power. You probably didn't hear about that because when media covered it, few mentioned the requirement that by 2026, every American car must monitor the driver, determine if he is impaired, and if so, limit vehicle operation. Representative Thomas Massie objected, complaining that the law makes government judge, jury, and executioner on such fundamental right. Congress approved the law anyway. A USA Today fact check told readers, don't worry, there's no kill switch in the Biden bill. They didn't read it because it's there, says automotive engineer and former vintage race car driver Lauren Fix in a new video. The clause is buried under Section 24220 of the law. Well, USA Today's fact check didn't lie exactly. It acknowledged that the law requires new cars to have technology that identifies if a driver is impaired and prevents operation. Apparently, they just didn't like the term kill switch. But it is just that. Mothers Against Drunk Driving want that, and one can understand while keeping people off the road who are impaired might be a good idea. I say to fix It would save lives. Are you willing to give up every bit of control of your life? She asks. Only you give that up. You have no more freedom. This computer decides you can't drive your vehicle. Great, unless someone's having a heart attack and trying to get to the hospital. Well, the kill switch is just one of several ways the government proposes to control how we drive. California lawmakers want new cars to have a speed governor that prevents you from going more than 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. That would reduce speeding, but not being able to speed is dangerous too, says Fix. If something's coming at you, you have to make an adjustment. New cars will have a special button on the dash. If you suddenly need to speed and manage to find the button when you're trying to drive out of someone's bad situation, it lets you speed for 15 seconds. For all these new safety devices to work, cars need to spy on their drivers. Before I researched this, Dossel says, I didn't realize that they already do. The Mozilla Foundation reports that car makers collect things like your age, gender, ethnicity, driver's license number, your purchase history, and tendencies. They collect information about your sex life. How? Cars aim video cameras at passengers. Other devices listen to conversations and intercept text messages. Then, says Mozilla, 76% of the car companies sell your data. I just bought a new car. I say to Fix. Nobody told me about this. Oh, it's there, she replies. Buy a new car. You get that really long document. The small print says, we're collecting your data. We know everything you're doing in your car, and we own that data. There's nothing you can do about it if you keep the car. Finally, Biden's infrastructure bill also includes a pilot program to tax you based on how you drive. A mileage charge seems fair, Stossel says to Fix. You pay for your damage to the road. Correct, she replies. But when you start allowing them to do this, they could say, we don't want you to buy a firearm. We don't want you to go to that destination. So we're not going to let you start your car. It's about control. Stossel pushed back. They're not controlling me. Oh, they can, Fix replies. Wait until you get a bill for your carbon footprint. You're at the maximum for carbon credits. We're not going to let you drive today. Take the train, take the electric bus. This is a paranoia, Stossel suggests. Maybe, says Fix. But so far, everything that I've said about these things, each step keeps coming through. So the kill switch is just the short version. Well, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass is pleading with the most fortunate to help fund housing for the homeless as part of a new strategy to tackle the crisis during her State of the City address on Monday. We will not hide people, but what we will do is house people, the Democrat leader touted as she began her remarks on the city's struggle to house some 40,000 homeless people. The crisis on our streets is nothing less than a disaster, she said. She touted the success of her signature Inside Safe program, which moved over 21,000 homeless people into temporary shelters, according to the Associated Press. She insisted this strategy and the system moving the homeless into temporary housing would eventually end the homelessness crisis in Los Angeles. Acknowledging the costliness of this endeavor, she asked the wealthy to help speed up the housing purchases for the homeless. Right now, we're working to move past nightly rentals. We're asking the most fortunate Angelenos to participate in this effort with personal, private sector, and philanthropic funds to help us acquire more properties, lower the cost of capital, and speed up housing. Meanwhile, Mexico's once all-powerful drug lord, El Chapo Guzman, is claiming he can't get phone calls or visits in the maximum security U.S. prison where he's serving a life sentence. El Chapo penned his complaint to the district judge, Brian Cogan, in the Eastern District of New York in late March, complaining that he hadn't been able to speak to his twin daughters. The facility stopped giving me calls with my daughters, and I haven't had calls with them for 7 months, he complained. I have asked when they're going to give me the time and access, but they haven't given the answer he wants. El Chapo said that being barred from receiving outside communication was unprecedented, and it was discriminatory. It is unprecedented and discrimination against me, he said. They decided to punish me by not letting me talk to my daughters. Well, Cogan responded last week denying the request. He said once the drug lord was convicted, all arrangements were in the U.S. Bureau of Prisons' hands. Known as Mexico's most notorious drug lord, Guzman was convicted in New York in February of running an industrial-scale smuggling operation and a killing machine. So he doesn't have access to his daughters, but then again, his victims don't have access to their families either. All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Coming up in our next segment, Kayla Tony, she's Associate Counsel at First Liberty Institute. We'll talk about a school in Washington where they've denied two elementary school girls who happen to be sisters to establish a prayer club that would also do community service, despite the fact that they support some 12 other clubs, and one as recent as a week before they denied this particular club. That's coming up in the next segment. Well, Senator Marsha Blackburn is planning to propose new legislative action that would threaten to cut National Public Radio's federal funding if passed, prompted by the news that it suspended an editor who has now resigned, who went viral for exposing the outlet's partisan uniformity in its newsroom. The Tennessee Republican is weighing a variety of legislative options to take on federal funding that goes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which provides funding to NPR in the form of grants. She is specifically looking to prevent NPR from benefiting from public funds due to what her office characterized as left-wing bias. The mainstream media has become obsessed with doing the left's bidding and taking down strong conservatives, and NPR has led the pack, Blackburn said in a statement. It makes no sense that the American people are forced to fund a propagandist left-wing outlet that refuses to represent the voices of half the country. NPR should not receive our tax dollars, end quote. Well, Blackburn previously looked to sever the government's funding to NPR back in 2011 when she was serving in the House of Representatives. At the time, the Republican-controlled House passed a measure that sought to cut $50 million from CPB. The time has come for us to claw back this money, Blackburn reportedly said at that time. Well, public broadcasting is fully funded by the federal government per the nonprofit's website. The organization provides funding in the form of grants to both NPR and PBS, Public Broadcasting Services. The grants to NPR are used for its international bureaus and distribution infrastructure that provides content to all public radio stations. NPR veteran editor Yuri Berliner was recently suspended without pay from NPR following his public criticism of his employer. As mentioned, he resigned earlier today. The suspension was made public on Tuesday, but began last Friday. According to NPR media reporter David Folkenflik, the organization reportedly told Berliner on Thursday that his punishment was a final warning and that if he violated NPR's policy on employees seeking approval to do work for other news outlets, he would be fired. I love NPR and I feel it's a national trust, he said in an interview with Folkenflik. We have great journalists here. If they shed their opinions and did the great journalism they're capable of, this would be a much more interesting and fulfilling organization for our listeners, end quote. The senior NPR business editor said that he made several attempts to relay his concerns before choosing to publish an essay in the Free Press, but they weren't heard by the organization's leadership. In Berliner's scathing review of his employer's ideological stance, he revealed that there were 87 registered Democrats working in editorial positions at the Washington, D.C. headquarters and zero Republicans, none. He said that such a lack of viewpoint diversity seeped into the outlet's coverage, criticizing NPR's approach to a variety of prominent stories over the years, including allegations that former President Trump colluded with Russia in the 2016 election, the laptop belonging to President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and the theory that COVID-19 was triggered by a lab leak in China. A spokesperson for Representative Ronnie Jackson said that he is also trying to advance legislation in the House to defund NPR that he says he has introduced on multiple occasions, including the current Congress. Mr. Berliner describes himself as a moderate liberal who hates Donald Trump. A government watchdog group is suing the Biden administration over documents it sought via information requests related to proposed regulations targeting menthol cigarettes. Protect the Public's Trust filed a federal lawsuit against the Department of Health and Human Services, alleging that the agency has violated its obligations under the Freedom of Information Act. Protect the Public's Trust submitted to four Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, requests for documents pertaining to the proposed federal menthol cigarette ban with HHS and subagency, the Food and Drug Administration, late last year, all of which have gone unfulfilled. Well, they described PPT, the Protect the Public's Trust, describes itself as nonpartisan, a project dedicated to ensuring there is only one standard, one set of rules that our leaders must live by, no matter what party affiliation or ideological bent, according to its website. It's headed by Michael Chamberlain, a former communication official with the Department of Education in the Trump administration. The Biden administration and FDA probably thought they would be greeted as conquering heroes when they announced the menthol ban, Chamberlain said in a statement, but the science and, as they soon found out, the politics appear to be a lot more complicated than that. The rule is highly controversial, and it's important for the American public to understand the factors driving the administration's actions here, he went on to say. But despite our best efforts and Mr. Biden's claim of running the most transparent administration in history, the agencies won't produce records. That seems to indicate there's something they don't want the public to know, end quote. Well, PPT filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Health and Human Services and FDA in December. The request asked for communications between the several senior officials related to the menthol ban. However, in more than 90 days since the four requests, the HHS has not produced responsive documents and hasn't communicated the scope of the documents it intends to produce or withhold, according to the organization. Well, as such, the group argues that Health and Human Services has not met its statutory obligations to provide the requested information. The regulations, which would broadly ban menthol cigarette sales nationwide, were first proposed by the FDA 2 years ago and sent to the White House for final approval months ago. The proposed crackdown on menthol cigarettes has sparked a contentious debate between health advocates who favor the regulations and civil liberties and business groups which oppose the regulations. Groups representing minorities like the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement and the nonprofit National Action Network, the latter of which was founded by Reverend Al Sharpton, argue that banning menthol cigarettes while not restricting non-menthol cigarettes puts a microscope on minority communities. They say it could increase the probability of negative interactions between police and minorities. I'm not sure how you get there from here, but that's what they're alleging. Meanwhile, Senator Bob Menendez is expected to blame his wife during his federal corruption trial as part of a defense strategy. Newly unsealed court documents have revealed, in court documents obtained, attorneys for Senator Menendez argued for his case to be severed because of his intention to introduce evidence that would imply his wife, Nadine, is guilty. Severing a case means that the co-defendants would be tried separately in two trials rather than one as a couple. The couple have both pleaded not guilty to bribery and obstruction of justice charges. They're accused of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes in the form of cash, gold bars, and a Mercedes-Benz for the benefit of various business persons and the Egyptian government. Nadine's case was already severed by the time the documents, which were filed in January, came to light on Tuesday, but the documents hint at what evidence may come to light at the trial. In the court filing, attorneys imply that Democratic senator will introduce evidence showing he was unaware of the allegedly illegal activities. The lawyers say Menendez may testify about communications with his wife that could exonerate him but may implicate Nadine, who allegedly withheld information from her husband. Well, earlier in April, Nadine Menendez's attorney requested to postpone her trial after an unexpected medical development arose. She was diagnosed with a serious medical condition on the 9th of this month, according to her attorneys. Automotive expert Mike Caudill says American drivers ought to absolutely be concerned about whether the new digital technology used in electric vehicles and some gas-powered cars is collecting their data and giving it to questionable actors like the Chinese Communist government. Well, the transportation expert and entrepreneur said recently about the rise of EVs and how technology utilized in their onboard instruments could be used to spy on Americans, and whether corporations on foreign governments have more access to American vehicles than they're aware of. Concerns about potential unwanted data breaches in electric cars have grown as Chinese automakers have become a force to be reckoned with in the global electric vehicle market. Chinese company BYD has overtaken Tesla as the largest EV company in the world this year. And some experts are worried that when Americans start buying these vehicles, the Chinese manufacturers would be able to monitor them from overseas. Well, it's rather interesting, the mess that we are in these days with technology. Up next, a conversation with Kayla Toney, Associate Counsel for First Liberty. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Well, First Liberty Institute sent a letter to officials with the Issaquah School District on behalf of two elementary school students and their parents, demanding students be allowed to start an interfaith prayer club at the school. Sounds reasonable. Well, the school actively promotes more than a dozen non-religious clubs, including the Pride Club and the Green Team. Well, denying the formation of a religious student club while allowing other clubs violates the Constitution. So says my next guest, who joins us to talk about this case. Kayla Toney is an associate counsel at First Liberty Institute, focusing on religious liberty and First Amendment rights. She joins us today to talk about this case, where it stands, and what is likely to happen next. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I suppose it shouldn't be altogether surprising that this kind of case has arisen, because we're seeing across the country challenges to the free exercise of religion. But here we have yet another case. Give us a little bit of the backstory. These two elementary school students wanted to establish a club. For what reason? And include the fact that one of them had not felt safe and welcome to express her faith on campus.
Yes, exactly. We represent a fifth grader named Laura, along with her younger sister, who would like to start a interfaith prayer club at her school, Creekside Elementary. It's in the Issaquah School District, which is right outside Seattle. And she had a really tough year. She felt very unwelcome as a person of faith, particularly with the politicized nature of her classroom and the focus on diversity in other forms, but not on religious diversity. And so as a way to bring students together from different backgrounds and help others feel welcome and safe, as well as herself, Laura had this great idea to start a prayer club. And so she asked the principal back in February if she could start the club, and the principal said no. She asked again and asked whether there were any obstacles, and the principal said clubs were determined in October and there was no more funding. Now, this does not seem like a good excuse, because the Pride Club had started just a week before Laura's request, and other clubs start, you know, at different times throughout the year. And Laura was not even requesting funding. All she wants is to gather with friends and pray and do community service projects. So we stepped in and we sent a demand letter on April 9 explaining to the school district how what they've done is wrong under the Constitution. Under the Free Exercise Clause, as you mentioned, it's discriminatory to deny a religious club while allowing other non-religious clubs to meet. And we're just waiting to see how the school district responds.
Well, it's incredible, because the Supreme Court weighed in on this larger question in another case, which we'll reference in just a few moments. But what strikes me is we're talking about an elementary school. We're talking about an 11-year-old girl and her sister, and they want to pray and they want to do community service. This is apparently some sort of a subversive group that the school cannot embrace. What explanation beyond there's no funding available, which they hadn't requested and don't need, was given by the school to suggest that, no, this group of elementary school students couldn't come together? And in fact, they were inviting students of all faiths to come together. Those who held to a religious belief system were invited to participate. So it wasn't even exclusive. What excuse has the school given beyond this funding thing?
There's not really any other excuses. And that's why we think it's pretty clear-cut religious discrimination. They just don't have a good reason to deny this club. And the irony is, there's a poster in Laura's classroom that's, of course, you know, decorated with rainbows, that says "Your voice matters." And yet the message she's received is that her voice does not matter at all. And that's been really hard to receive.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, she mentions that She had not felt safe. She had an experience the last school year where she was made to feel very uncomfortable because of her religious faith. And this was an opportunity for like-minded students to come together as a bit of solace and then to reach out and minister to the to their community. So this is really outrageous. Creekside Elementary School is in Sammamish, Washington. It's just short of a short distance from Bremerton High School, where Coach Joe Kennedy was fired for praying on the football field. The Supreme Court spoke to this subject in that case. Can you remind us and tell us whether or not that relates to this case and if their words would reflect on and be relevant to this case?
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned the Kennedy case. We were honored as First Liberty to represent Coach Kennedy in mm-hmm. that very fight. And it's been very encouraging to see already the positive results from that strong precedent at the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court held in a very strong 6-3 ruling that the First Amendment provides double protection for people of faith. And that's because both the Free Speech Clause and the Free Exercise Clause protect Americans' ability to live out and express their faith in public. And that includes employees and students in public schools. It's a great win for people of all faiths. And, you know, certainly if employees are protected, and they are, as we found with Coach Kennedy, how much more are students protected when, you know, they voluntarily want to gather after school and pray? This is a clear right. And an additional thing that the Kennedy case did that's very significant in the legal landscape is that it overturned a previous ruling, which was very harmful to people of faith. It's called the Lemon Test, and it left a sour taste in all of our mouths. And that was the rule that essentially said religion does not have a place in the public schools. No more prayer, no more Bible reading, no more nativity displays unless there's Santa and reindeer right next door. And even, you know, judges were starting to criticize this test because they really saw how subjective it was and how, you know, it had this unintended effect of really ousting religion from the public sphere. And the Supreme Court in Kennedy said that they have long ago abandoned the Lemon Test, that it's dead and buried. And now we look to history and tradition. Now, of course, there's a long tradition of students being able to voluntarily pray and express their faith in schools. And then we also look for elements of coercion. And for Coach Kennedy, there was no coercion. He was just kneeling on the field, and if students decided to join, they were welcome. And again, with this prayer club, there's no coercion. It's simply students just wanting to come together from different faiths and support each other and do community service.
And particularly when there are emblems in the classroom promoting other students with other backgrounds, it seems utterly indefensible that they would not allow these students to gather for the purpose of prayer and community service. Now, the principal met a couple of times with the mother and again twice in February, apparently, but they have declined to allow this club. Where does this situation stand at this point? We're already in mid-April. The school year will end sometime in late May or June. Where does this stand?
That's right. We've given the school 2 weeks to respond to our demand letter, so they have until April 22nd. To do the right thing, and all they need to do to avoid a long, drawn-out lawsuit is to go ahead and approve Laura's prayer club so that she can meet a few times before the school year ends. Laura's in fifth grade. She's about to leave for middle school, and so it's extra important to her to have the opportunity to pray with friends before that time runs out. However, if the school district does not agree to do the right thing and approve her club, we will sue in federal court, and we are fully prepared to litigate for as long as this takes because we think the principle underlying it is very, very significant.
Well, absolutely. There will be students to follow, Laura, and they may want to do something similar. They may want to meet with classmates or at least know that that's a possibility, that the district is not discriminating against those who hold religious convictions. And that in and of itself is significant to move forward with this case. Well, one would like to hope that the principal, the school district, would do the right thing, that they would avoid the expense and the time necessary to address this in court. But if necessary, I am grateful that First Liberty Institute is prepared and willing to walk alongside this elementary school student who's about to go to middle school and resolve this question once and for all for future students in that district and across the state.
Well, thank you. We so appreciate your interest and support in this important case. And I should mention, too, that Laura's community is very diverse. There's people from all different backgrounds, many that have come for, you know, jobs in the tech industry and are more recent arrivals to the United States. A lot of her friends are Muslim and Jewish and Hindu and Buddhist, and she's from a Latter-day Saint background. And so there's really a beautiful vision that she has here to bring students together, to make her school a friendlier place to people of faith. And we're just so honored to stand beside her and her sister as they're pursuing this vision.
Well, and the district must ultimately, even if they're compelled to do so, acknowledge that faith is welcome in a public school setting. Kayla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, Kayla Toney is associate counsel at First Liberty Institute. She focuses on religious liberty and First Amendment rights.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. My next guest asks the question, what if we looked at prayer not as an obligation, but saw it for what it is, a privilege? Well, Pastor Andrew Carter, he believes we've lost the biblical vision of what prayer really is, an exciting, risky, faith-filled journey that pushes the limitations of our imaginations, made possible through the unrivaled intimacy with the Creator of the universe. Wow. And he believes it's time to remember the power in prayer, recognizing it as the essential ingredient for an effective life of following Jesus, rather than a chance for quick pleas for help or list of requests. Well, in his new book, The Privilege of Prayer, Find Healing, Transformation, and Answers, he empowers his listeners, his readers rather, to connect with God in ways you never thought possible, to engage in open, honest, and transparent prayer, and to cultivate an expectant, consistent prayer life. Well, we're going to talk with Pastor Carter here. He is the founder and lead pastor of Royal City Church. He's been the speaker at churches, events, conferences, and retreats, and is known for his testimony going from prisoner to pastor. He creates influential social media content for his millions of followers, and he joins us today. And I should mention, he's a husband and father as well. He joins us today to talk about his book, The Privilege of Prayer. Thank you so much for joining us, Pastor Carter.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going very, very well. You know, it's remarkable to me to consider that we have been given access to the throne of grace through our Lord Jesus Christ. And somehow we shrink back. We don't take full advantage or perhaps understand what prayer is really all about and what a privilege it is. In your book, you argue that we've lost the biblical vision of what prayer really is. So what are we missing? Why do we struggle?
I think it's because we see it as an obligation, as something that we have to do and not something that we get to do. Like, it's exciting and adventurous. And it's this beautiful opportunity to communicate to the Creator of the universe. And many times we just relegate it to something we mumble before we eat our food or when we're finding ourselves in the middle of a crisis.
Is it that we don't fully appreciate that God has a purpose to give his attention to our prayer, that we have communion with God? Do we just not understand it? Are we not in the scriptures? Are we not being taught from the pulpit? Where do we fall short?
Yeah, I think Bible illiteracy is at an all-time high. Most people, especially in today's day and age, don't know the Word of God. They don't know how to pray. They don't know what to pray. There's a lot of misconceptions about prayer and how to do it, when to do it, why we do it. It's us falling short in really establishing what that really is, like giving a solid foundation of what prayer truly is.
Well, let's talk about your journey into consistent prayer. And we'll define consistent prayer in just a bit. But how did you come to fully appreciate and engage in God, our Creator, in prayer as we are invited to?
You know, it started actually in my fitness journey. I started fitness and I owned a gym years ago. And what I realized is that it comes from consistency and discipline over time. And so no matter what area of your life, whether it's your physical, your financial, or your spiritual, when you show up consistently and put in effort, results always come. And so in the same way, I just applied that same principle to my spiritual life. I show up and I pray, whether I'm tired, whether I don't want to, or if I don't feel like I have enough time, I show up anyway. And what I realized is when I would fight through those barriers and obstacles and press into prayer, 99.9% of the time, I feel better. I feel more connected to God, and I'm better prepared for whatever the day has lying ahead of me.
I think many of us believe that we have to somehow impress God by the way we phrase our conversation with him, that he has an expectation that we're going to speak the King's English or that we pray like somebody does from the pulpit at church. What are some of the prayer basics that you write about in The Privilege of Prayer?
I tell people that it's just got to be open, honest, transparent, and vulnerable communication. Like, God wants to know us, not a manicured, highlight, photoshopped version of ourselves. He wants to know our innermost being. And so we can come to him because of what Jesus did on the cross as we are. He wants to know our thoughts and our groanings and our complaints. Like, none of our prayers are too big or too small for him. So I tell people to come as you are in prayer and just show up.
I think for some of us, we don't really understand the purpose of prayer. We know that God knows all things, so why should I bother expressing my heart to him? We don't appreciate what this connection with the creator of the universe, the sustainer of the universe, the lover of our soul, we don't fully appreciate what the purpose of prayer is. Can you, as a pastor, just help us to better understand why is it that God wants to have that kind of conversation with us when it's really not necessary for him to become informed? Why should we approach him, and what's our purpose?
I would use one word, and that word would be intimacy. God desires a relationship with us as his creation, as we are children of God. I'm a father. I've got four kids. And, you know, I desire intimacy with my kids. And the older they get, the harder it becomes for them to text back or pick up the phone to call me. But I desire relationship and intimacy. It's not necessarily about me knowing what's going on. It's just that desire that of all of the things, all of the friends and all of the opportunities they have to do other stuff, that they're thinking about me, that they care about me, and that they love me. And in the same way, that's what God's looking for. It's not necessarily for us to try to twist his arm into answering mm-hmm. our prayers. It's that, hey, we're putting you first. We're seeking your face, and we want your presence more than we want just your presence.
Oh, that's so good. You offer in your book, The Privilege of Prayer, a biblical template for prayer. Certainly Jesus taught his disciples. Help us to understand a template, how we approach him in prayer in a way that's pleasing to him and also helps us to deepen our intimacy with him.
Yeah, it just plays off of the Lord's Prayer. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Jesus gave us the beautiful and simple, simplest template possible. And so I just kind of emphasize what it is that he does. He says, you know, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And so that first part is just honoring God, revering him, exalting him to that holiest place, like understanding who he is. And so when we enter into prayer, I believe that it's important that we understand that we're on holy ground, that we honor his name. And he says, in different parts, he says, give us today our daily bread. Forgive me for my sins. So there's different aspects of the Lord's Prayer where he's just laying it out. Hey, go in with a heart of gratitude. Ask for provision for today. Don't be consumed by tomorrow's problems. You got enough today. Just ask for today's daily bread. He says, lead me not into temptation. You're asking for today's guidance. We don't need a game plan for tomorrow, but just God, give us a guiding light and lead us today. So I'm really just taking the Lord's Prayer and simplifying some of the key elements for us to put our personal prayers into.
And, you know, that's so healthy. We are familiar with the prayer. We can recite it, but maybe we don't understand fully everything that example sets for us and how we approach God in a way that is so practical. And I appreciate your emphasis, as the Lord's Prayer does. We don't have to ask about 10 years from now, that there's enough for today. Lord, be with me and give me what I need today. And he invites us to do that.
Yeah. I like the big part where he says, your will be done, right? Your will be done. And it's just this surrender of, like, I can ask for all things, but you know what? At the end of the day, if not from you, if it's not what you want, then I don't want it. Your will be done.
Again, we are invited to a conversation and relationship with God. What does it do in and for us as we yield to this pattern that he's established for us? I think prayer is as much for us in helping us to think clearly about who we are and our relationship with God and our need for him. But what's the value for us as we are obedient in coming to him in prayer and deepening our relationship for him?
Again, one word, I would say reliance. It's a reliance upon him, going to him. Too many times in today's generation, we run to everything except for God or comfort. We run to food. We run to social media. People run to drugs and alcohol. And this isn't condemning. It's merely shining a light on what we tend to run to as human beings. We have the proclivity to run towards everything but the Lord. And so with this daily prayer, it teaches and trains us to rely on him for strength, endurance, for guidance, for when you're in the middle of a situation, like for peace and for all of the things. So daily communion really helps us to daily rely on our God.
Yeah, absolutely. In your book, The Privilege of Prayer, you write about your past, including destructive behaviors and experiences with drugs and alcohol, multiple stints in jail. How did your personal journey help you to understand the privilege of prayer? I know when we're in desperate situations, we may call out to God for release, but how did this help to develop a deeper understanding of the privilege that we have in prayer?
I think that it really helped me to see a different point of view. The trouble that I got into, I didn't grow up in church. I didn't grow up, knowing Jesus. I thought he was about as real as the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. And so I think that it gives me a unique perspective. I spent more time in the world than I did in the Word. And so I see that in the world, people are chasing after all of these things. They're running after rocks and tarot cards and Ouija boards and all this new age stuff. They're spiritual and they're hungry. They're looking for truth, but they're finding it in other places. And so what it helped me understand is that people want truth. And if I spend time in prayer, I know the Lord. It gives me a testimony and it gives me a foundation to share with those who are hungry. And it also gives me more of a common ground to those who are searching and seeking, the lost, the people who are actually hungry. I feel like I relate a little bit more to them, and they're more willing to listen to somebody who's not as polished and maybe been around for a little bit longer, because know that I'm not coming from a place of judgment, but more of a place of familiarity.
Yeah, which, you know, really all of us should have, because all of us have sinned and fallen short. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation with Pastor Andrew Carter. He is the author of The Privilege of Prayer, Finding Healing, Transformation, and Answers. The book is published by Chosen Baker, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. Is aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgene Rice. I'm continuing my conversation with Pastor Andrew Carter. He is the founder and lead pastor of Royal City Church and the author, most recently, of The Privilege of Prayer, Find Healing, Transformation, and Answers, and reminding us of what a tremendous gift prayer is, thinking that Jesus is at the right hand of the Father making intercession for us. The Holy Spirit prays when we can't give word to what's in our heart, and we are invited into the throne room, and the fact that so few of us fully appreciate and take advantage of that opportunity. I'm grateful for a book that reminds us how to go about it and to put into perspective this great gift that we have been given. Now, what are some of the common things that you've seen hinder people's prayer life, and what's your advice for overcoming those things?
I would say that fear is one of the great obstacles that people wrestle with, and maybe even a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding how to pray. And what I would encourage people to do is to pray, even though you don't know how it's going to turn out. That's a part of our faith. Pray even if the answer is no, or if it's not yet, or yes. And I encourage people to pray without ceasing. You don't have to fold your hands. You don't have to close your eyes. You don't have to always get on your knees. I think there's times where it's important to get on your knees and pray, to close your eyes, to find him in that secret place. But as I go throughout my day, I'm praying and having a full-blown conversation with God without it being a formal sit-down prayer.
Yeah, that's so important. When you're in your car, when you're sitting at your desk, whatever you may happen to be doing. One of the parts of the book is on discerning answers to prayer. I think oftentimes we pray, but we have no anticipation that God has heard us or that there will be an answer. Now, sometimes that answer is no. Sometimes it unfolds in a different way, but God responds to us. Talk a little bit about this section of your book, discerning answers to prayer.
Yeah, I like to tell people that no is an answer. So many people say, well, God's not answering my prayers, but the truth of the matter is he's probably answering it. You just don't like what it's saying. And so I got to remind people, hey, God's not a genie. He's not here to grant our every wish. The beauty of God is that he's playing chess while we're playing checkers. We might be asking for things that could lead to our demise, that could completely fold our lives into pieces. We don't know the repercussions of some of the things that we're asking. In fact, I look back at my life and I say many times, thank you, God, for not giving me what it is that I thought needed in that season, because I got to remind myself, God knows best. So when you think that God's not answering, sit back and go, well, maybe he is, and maybe the answer is just no. And if it's no, I'd rather have God's no than my way, because what I want isn't always what's best.
That's absolutely right. You write about three important things to pray for, and it's not a list of demands, which is how oftentimes we approach prayer. This is my list of demands. I love you. Goodbye. I got other things to do. What are the three important things to pray for?
I would say three, and I write about three, but I'm going to add one. It's an edit. It would be knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and discernment. I feel like if we were to get knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and discernment, many of the prayers that we pray would be unnecessary. And I'll give you an example. Many times we're praying for a financial breakthrough. You maybe need a windfall, or you want to win a lucky lotto ticket, or you want some kind of financial increase. But I believe if we would ask God to give us wisdom, discernment, knowledge, and the other one, I already lost my train of thought. If you would ask for those, God would help you better steward your finances. Maybe the answer to your prayer is not having as many streaming services or not eating out as much. Maybe if we had the wisdom, knowledge, or understanding to be better stewards of the finances we needed, we wouldn't be in need of one of these big windfalls or this big financial blessing.
Well, that is so important. You write about the blessing of the closed door. You touched on that just a moment ago. So often as we're asking and the door closes, we imagine that God is angry with us, that maybe we didn't put it in quite the right way. But it's important for us to recognize that a closed door is helping us to live according to his purpose and his call, rather than just saying, no, you're not worthy of, whatever it is that you think you need.
Yeah, I like to say that a closed door is for God's protection, his redirection, or for keeping us for settling for less than what he made us for. And I like to use the illustration of my kids. You know, if my kids came and asked me at midnight, they woke me up out of bed and said, hey, Dad, I'd like a serving of ice cream. What they're asking for isn't bad. It's not that I don't love them or don't care about them. It's that, hey, ice cream at midnight's not a good idea. So my answer to them would be no, not right now. What many kids would take that as is, well, my dad doesn't love me. He doesn't care about me. He doesn't want me to live my best life. He's keeping me from having a good time. And in the same way, that's how many of us react when God says no or not yet. And again, I'm saying no to protect them, because I know if they have ice cream at midnight, they're going to get jacked up on sugar. They're not going to sleep well. It's going to affect them in school the next day. And in the same way, we got to understand that God, as a father, is looking out for us in our best interest. So he's closing doors to protect us, redirect us, or to keep us from settling for less than what he made us for.
That's so good. You touched on this earlier in our conversation in the previous segment, but what's the importance of being consistent in our prayer life? I think most of us, and I'm generalizing, are hit and miss. There may not be the consistency. There's not a time of day when we say, I'm going to spend time with God, or it's only transient when I'm moving from here to there. Why is it important that we are consistent?
Oh, I think habits are everything. Many of us come home and turn on the TV out of habit, or we jump in the car and turn on music before adjusting our mirrors or putting on our seatbelt out of habit. And I just believe creating a prayer habit or even a devotion habit, I think that creating spiritual disciplines that become habits consistently, they help us, because some days you wake up and you don't feel like it. You might be sick. You might be tired. You might be on the go. But when you create these spiritual habits through consistency and discipline, then it's almost like autopilot. The first thing I do when I wake up, not because I'm necessarily conscious of it, but I thank God for giving me another day. It becomes a habit. It becomes routine. And not to say that it loses its power or becomes ineffective because it's on autopilot, but it definitely helps me be more aware of the presence of God and more likely to dive deeper in my prayer.
Yes, yeah, certainly gives you perspective. We're talking with Andrew Carter, author of The Privilege of Prayer. What do you want people to understand the most about the power of prayer as it relates to their relationship with Jesus?
I would just say that it's a privilege, just like the title of the book. It's a privilege and not an obligation. We have to start reframing the way we see prayer. It's not something that you just rattle off before you eat food. It's not something you just run to in a crisis. Like, we have access to the creator of all things because of what Jesus did on the cross. There's no greater privilege. And I would encourage people to start reframing, like, I get to talk to God. I don't want to be a bearer of bad news, but if you don't want to talk to God now, I don't know what makes you think heaven's going to be any more fun. That's all we get to do is sit in his presence and worship and talk with him. So you might as well start now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, we don't want to have a blind date where we don't even recognize him because we've never had a conversation. Now, for those who are currently struggling in their prayer life, as we close our conversation, what do you say to them?
I would encourage them just to show up. Start today and show up. God hears your cries, your groans, your mumbles, your tears. Your tears have power. I would say just show up as you are, be open, honest, transparent, and vulnerable, and let the Holy Spirit do what the Holy Spirit does. He intercedes on our behalf, and we'll start to give you the right words. You start to get a rhythm, a consistency, and your prayer life starts to take off.
Amen. Andrew Carter, the author of The Privilege of Prayer, Find Healing, Transformation, and Answers. The book is published by Chosen. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Stick around. There's more to come.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Portland-only edition of the Georgene Rice Show, at least for these two segments. Well, leaders in the San Diego area called for stronger border enforcement Monday evening after a motorboat loaded with suspected illegal immigrants ran ashore the Carlsbad Beach over the weekend. We have no idea who they are. We have no idea where they are. And these people were not vetted at all. That's a quote from San Diego County Supervisor Jim Desmonds at a press conference on Monday evening, calling the boat landing a coordinated effort. Video shared widely on social media showed a boat speeding between surfers before running ashore on Saturday. More than a dozen people jumped off the boat and ran into the city, with some hopping into waiting cars. Migrants have long snuck into the U.S. by way of the Pacific Ocean, but over the last 3 years, California has seen an exponential increase in maritime smuggling. Brandon Tucker, director of the Customs and Border Protection's Air and Marine Operations in San Diego, says. Well, since fiscal year 2020, maritime smuggling events, which can also include trafficking drugs and other contraband in California, have increased nearly 140%, according to CBP. Well, Desmond previously told Fox News it was untenable and unsustainable to have people just coming in and walking into neighborhoods from another country. Quite frankly, it's pretty scary, I would think, for people living right along the coast. Well, the chaos at the border and the fact that many of these crossers know there'll be no consequence encountering them and make the cities less safe. The Oceanside Deputy Mayor Ryan Keem, according to local news, opined, California state law bars local police from working with Border Patrol and other federal agencies to enforce immigration laws. So there's nothing they can do. Well, Desmond said the latest viral boat landing shows that it's time to end incentives and sanctuary. Land border encounters in Southern California have also increased dramatically in recent years. So far, the San Diego sector has seen more than 185,000 encounters in fiscal year 2024, and it's only April. That's up nearly 70% from the same period last year, according to Border Patrol. Well, Iran fired more than 320 warheads at Israel on Saturday. The explosives were carried by about 170 propeller-driven drones of the kind Iran has sold Russia for use against Ukraine. More than 30 cruise missiles and more than 120 ballistic missiles, mostly fired from Iranian territory, at least 1,100 miles away to the east, with a few launched from more distant Houthi-controlled Yemen to the south. The attack failed to deliver any meaningful damage, though a 10-year-old girl was injured, as 99% of the drones and missiles were intercepted by Israel, the U.S., and likely Jordan and Saudi Arabia as well. What Iran's large-scale attack on Israel, more than twice as large as any Russian attack on Ukraine, did was show the value of layered anti-missile defense championed by former President Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump and opposed by President Joe Biden when he served in the U.S. Senate. Iran's triple threat attack was defeated by fighter jets, Israeli short-range Iron Dome system, David's Sling, a kinetic hit-to-kill interceptor system with a range out to about 186 miles away, and Israel's Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 systems developed with the United States beginning in the 1980s. The U.S. Navy also fired anti-ballistic missile rockets from warships nearby. But had Biden had his way in 1987, Israel wouldn't have had this sophisticated and highly effective missile defense system. Shortly after the Republicans lost their U.S. Senate majority in 1986 in the election, Democrats redoubled their efforts to terminate Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. It was a destabilizing waste of money, they said. They argued on one hand that it cost too much and it wouldn't work anyway. And on the other hand, if it did work, it would increase the likelihood of a life-ending nuclear war. But with Israel's advances in defense technology, combined with its location in a dangerous neighborhood, and a bipartisan argument could be made that Israel would benefit from development of anti-missile technology, while America would benefit from Israel's testing data and lessons learned. Thus was born Israel's Arrow anti-ballistic missile system. It's important to note that at the time, the Arrow had its critics in both America and Israel. Aside from Biden and largely anti-defense left, the Israeli Air Force was skeptical, fearing a diversion of resources from its ability to deter attacks on Israeli soil through what was euphemistically called preemptive diplomacy, the threat of first strikes to destroy emerging dangers. But Israel's Ministry of Defense believed that an effective anti-missile defense would blunt the destruction of an enemy surprise attack, allowing Israel the luxury of not having to conduct diplomatically costly preemptive strikes. That has now been borne out. In the wake of Iran's foiled attack on Israel, Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to take the win and not strike back, further driving the point home, likely to appeal to the Democrats' growing problem with their anti-Semitic left-wing base. Biden said he wouldn't support an Israeli counterattack. But just because a would-be murderer failed doesn't mean that a criminal should escape justice. In the meantime, domestic pressure is mounting to force Israel to relent in its effort to defend itself by eliminating the threat of adjacent terrorist groups. Terrorist sympathizers in Chicago shut down the road to the city's airport, an increasing chance of death to America and death to Israel, aiming to change U.S. policy toward Israel continue. Well, this brings to mind the Cold War era revelation from high-level Soviet defector Colonel Stanislav Luniev, a military intelligence officer, that the Soviet Union's clandestine agencies provided more resources for anti-war propaganda in the United States than it did for economic and military support of the Vietnamese. The People's Republic of China has a simple doctrine with regard to American interests. Whatever U.S. supports, it opposes. Whatever the U.S. opposes, it supports. With China openly opposing Israel's efforts to defend itself and in possession of an economy several times larger than the Soviet Union at its peak, as well as having powerful propaganda tools such as TikTok, one can only guess at the extent to which China is involved in whipping up anti-Israel, pro-terror hysteria in America. Well, yesterday was a good day for the rule of law, at least in a ceremonial sense, as House Republicans somberly walked the articles of impeachment against the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate, which led to a battle between the august body's narrowly divided political parties. The dispute, whether to hold a constitutionally prescribed Senate trial at all, such is the sorry state of our politics. Well, earlier today, the Senate voted not to take up the case, and some have charged that that means the Constitution was simply thwarted and law was and justice was not undertaken. If you missed my commentary on that early in the program, you can check it out on our podcast. Life's tough all over these days, especially for illegal immigrants, around 1,300 of whom mobbed up at a city hall in New York City to demand their entitlements, their rightful free stuff. They were mostly from the West African nation of Guinea because, well, why not? They're flowing in freely from everywhere else. Apparently, an activist group said that work visas and green cards were to be distributed, and that word had spread around the migrant community. One On some level, administrators, bureaucrats, and wonks knew that someone was going to have to pay for all of these individuals entering the country one way or another. With that in mind, their plan is to put taxpayer money, jobs, homes, and lives where their rhetoric is. Well, in response to Iran's missile and drone attack against Israel over the weekend, the administration announced new sanctions against Iran. The missile barrage was the first time Iran had ever launched a direct attack against Israel. It was an act of war, and yet, due to Israel's Iron Dome defense system, the attack proved largely impotent this time. And that fact allowed the president to warn Israel against retaliating or responding, a warning meant to placate the radical anti-Israel members of his party's base. Well, that fact was driven home by the squad member, Representative Cori Bush, who was pleased that Biden advised Prime Minister Netanyahu that the U.S. will oppose any Israeli counterattacks against Iran. But to show that Biden is taking Iran's act of war seriously, his administration announced it will be raising new sanctions against Tehran. The extent of these sanctions has yet to be made clear. Recall that it was the Biden administration that released $6 billion to the regime in Tehran in exchange for hostages last year. Furthermore, Biden has been soft on Iran when it comes to its selling oil to China. And despite Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen asserting that all options are on the table when it comes to raising sanctions against Iran, Biden's record shows, well, otherwise. Well, Google employees were arrested for their anti-Israel protest in the CEO's office. It seems that some of Google's hard-left, Jew-hating employees can't stand the fact that their company is doing work with the Israeli government, including a $1.2 billion initiative called Project Nimbus. The sit-ins were announced via internal Google email, and they took place in two Google offices, New York City and Sunnyvale, California. Participants aimed high, too, going so far as to occupy the office of the Google Cloud CEO, Thomas Kurian. They uncorked a catchy ditty there in the CEO's office. Google, Google, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide. Well, a Google spokesperson said in part, physically impeding other employees' work and preventing them from accessing our facilities is a clear violation of our policies, and we will investigate and take action. Take action, they did. The employees were placed on administrative leave and their access to the Google system was suspended. I wonder, though, if these folks don't like their company business decisions, perhaps they ought to find some other place to work. Quick break. We'll be back to wrap things up.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, you're listening to the final segment of the Georgene Rice Show. Kind of piggybacking on what we talked about in the last segment, a constitutional law professor, Jonathan Turley, pointed out with regard to the Google employees who did their sit-in earlier today. He says this is part of the rather perverse universe we find ourselves in. They're Google. They're employees at the company. Free speech does not include disrupting others from speaking. It also doesn't include taking a salary and going in and stopping your business because you have a few things that you'd like to get off your chest. Well, Chinese communists apparently have a fentanyl economy. Would it not be an act of war for a foreign country to actively conspire to poison American citizens by the bushel? Asking for a dead friend. According to the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, China has been subsidizing the manufacture and export of illicit fentanyl precursor chemicals and other synthetic narcotics through tax rebates and other means. Well, former AG Bill Barr says the Chinese Communist Party is knee deep in the fentanyl crisis that's plaguing our nation to the funeral dirge of some 70,000 dead Americans every year. As Barr said in his interview this morning, it's clear that they're not acting in good faith. And when they do something, it's window dressing. They're knee deep in this. They're active. They're driving the trafficking. They're incentivizing the trafficking. End quote. Well, asked what the Chinese communist angle is in all of this, Barr says, I think a big part of it is strategic. That is, they believe it weakens the United States. It tells the world that we're a decadent society and a disciplined society like China's is the future, and it distracts us. And so it's bad for us. It's good for them. Barr isn't optimistic about any lessening of the crisis, at least not from the Biden administration, whose obedience to the Chinese communists knows no bounds. He says the Chinese and the Mexicans are giving us happy talk and that they're both complicit. Maybe it's time for a tougher foreign policy, one that puts the lives and interests of American citizens before the sensitivities of our greatest geopolitical foe. It's just a thought. Well, Germany is, well, climate crazy. It would seem that when the Germans decide to do anything, they do it to the extreme, or certainly with gusto. A case in point is Germany's commitment to net zero carbon emissions. Recently, German Transport Minister Volker Wissing, he warned that unless the country changes its net zero laws, people's weekend driving will have to be banned. Wissing, he explained that in order to meet the net zero target, Germans would effectively have to give up their leisure driving rights. A corresponding reduction in traffic performance would only be possible through restrictive measures that are difficult to communicate to the population, such as nationwide and indefinite driving bans on Saturdays and Sundays, he wrote last week. Curtailing individual freedom in the name of saving the planet is the playbook for the left across the West. Germany is simply further down the tyrannical green road than we are. And it should serve as a warning to the rest of us. Fortunately for car-loving Germans, Wissing's warning had an impact as the government agreed to a more moderated emissions law. Well, justices are divided over a January 6th participants' call to throw out an obstruction charge. Justice Gorsuch threw some shade on Jamal Bowman during the J6 hearing, and it's glorious. Gorsuch hammered the Biden Department of Justice on the mostly peaceful protests. Well, Planned Parenthood, more abortions, more tax dollars, and fewer health services. President Biden has taken over 200 actions against U.S. oil, and the president is planning a new 15% tariff on Chinese steel. Iran closed its nuclear facilities over fears they could be targeted in an Israeli strike. And California lawmakers watered down a bill making buying child prostitutes a felony. They've watered it down. Scotland's proposed misogyny law will protect men pretending to be women, a first minister says. And in a bit of humor, journalists at NPR suspended leading to shocking discovery there was a journalist at NPR. He has since resigned, by the way. Well, another special cosmic event is going to occur this year, and it could be a once-in-a-lifetime viewing opportunity, according to NASA. It's a nova explosion located in a star system some 3,000 light years away from Earth, and astronomers predict it will be visible to the unaided eye sometime this year. Unfortunately, we don't know the timing of this, as well as we know the eclipse. That's the lead for NASA's meteoroid. Can't say it. Environment Office, MEO, at NASA's Marshall Space Field Center in Huntsville, Alabama. But when it happens, it will be something you'll remember. If you see it, that is. A typical nova consists of a star like a red giant, a star bigger than the sun, and a white dwarf, which is a star about the size of the Earth. And that red giant is dumping material on the surface of the white dwarf. They're orbiting each other, and they're very close together. When enough material is dumped on the surface of the white dwarf, the temperature gets so hot that it starts a thermonuclear runway on the surface of that white dwarf. When that happens, the white dwarf blows all that material out into space, and it gets very bright, hundreds of times brighter than it was before. And if it's close to us or relatively close to us, we will see a new start to appear, a new in the sky. It's really quite fascinating. Well, before that star may require a telescope to see, the new star that's being formed, but all of a sudden it will flare into brightness that can be seen with the unaided naked eye. So that's an astronomical sight you might want to prepare to see at some point. We don't really know. Not very helpful, but there you have it. Well, on this day in history, 1492, a contract is signed by Christopher Columbus and a representative of Spain's King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, giving Columbus a commission to seek a westward ocean passage in Asia. Well, you know the rest, and probably the song that goes along with it. 1521, Martin Luther goes before the Diet of Worms to face charges stemming from his religious writings. 1924, the motion picture studio Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer is founded as a result of a merger of Metro Pictures, Goldwyn Pictures, and Louis B. Mayer Company. 1937, Daffy Duck makes his debut in the Warner Brothers animation cartoon Porky's Duck Hunt, directed by Tex Avery. 1961, some 1,500 CIA-trained Cuban exiles launched the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in an effort to topple Fidel Castro, whose forces would crush the incursion by the third day. 1964, Geraldine Jerry Mock becomes the first woman to complete a solo airplane trip around the world as she returns to Columbus, Ohio, after 29 and a half days in her Cessna 180. 1964, Ford Motor Company unveils the Mustang at the New York World's Fair. 1969, a jury in Los Angeles convicts Sirhan Sirhan of assassinating Senator Robert F. Kennedy. 1970, Apollo 13 astronauts James A. Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert, they splash down safely in the Pacific 4 days after a ruptured oxygen tank crippled their spacecraft while en route to the moon. 1973, Federal Express, later known as FedEx, begins operation as 14 planes carrying 186 packages takes off from Memphis International Airport, bound for 25 U.S. cities. And the rest, of course, is history. 1993, a federal jury in Los Angeles convicts two former police officers of violating the civil rights of beaten motorist Rodney King. Two other officers are acquitted. Rodney King is remembered for his statement, "Can't we just all get along?" 2009, Richard Phillips, the cargo ship captain rescued by Navy snipers from Somali pirates, makes a triumphant return to his home state of Vermont, insisting, "I'm not a hero. The military is." 2018, finally on this day in history, Barbara Bush, the first lady and wife of President George Herbert Walker Bush and mother of President George W. Bush and Florida Governor Jeb Bush, dies in Houston at age 92. Well, we are out of time. I do want to thank James Blend for producing, Dave King for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgene Rice Show part of your day. I hope you'll take the stories and the news that we've covered here today and make them a matter of prayer, that you're not guided by or overwhelmed by fear, but you remember who is sovereign, who sits on the throne, and you can sleep well tonight because you know the end, the rest of the story. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com and like us on Facebook and join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.